Hello again. I'm Stephen Saunders, an associate lecturer at the University of Central Florida. I'm a licensed psychologist and have been in practice since 1998. These podcasts are from a series of lectures I give in my teaching capacity at UCF. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved. If you'd like to contact me, you may do so at wstephensaunders@ucf.edu or call me at 352-406-0506. Enjoy the podcast. All right, now we're going to move on and talk a little bit about substance abuse disorders. Does anyone in here have a drug of use that you would like to admit that you partake in? I will go first. My drug of choice is alcohol, and I like it, usually on the rocks, well-aged. I love a good scotch. I had a delightful single malt scotch this past weekend. I went down to Marco Island with my lovely wife, and we stayed at the Marriott Resort there, the JW, which is really beautiful. And I was sitting, looking out at the beach inside this lovely lounge and having my single malt scotch. And oh, there's moments like that make life worth living. Right, and so I drank it down, and I had my low-level buzz, you know, which really is my brain cells getting killed off. But I experience it as euphoria and deeply enjoy it. So, you know, that's my drug of choice. Anyone else have a drug of choice you want to admit? You're also alcohol. Caffeine is certainly a drug, and that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's my second favorite drug of choice. And yeah, you know, we all imbibe caffeine on some level, unless you have a prohibition for it because of religious reasons or some other reason. But yeah, I mean, good Lord, sweet tea. My mama practically gave me sweet tea in the baby bottle. I grew up drinking that. I wouldn't say it was that bad, but almost that bad. You can't get sweet tea north of the Mason-Dixon line, though. It's a shame. When I moved to Massachusetts and I ordered sweet tea, they went, what? And I'm like, oh, my God, where am I? I felt like I'm in a foreign country. So substance abuse is simply excessive use. And excessive use meaning you are using it to the point that it's interfering in your day-to-day life. I fool myself into thinking I'm not an alcoholic because I have a rule that I don't drink alcohol during the week. If I don't drink alcohol during the week and I only drink in the weekends, I'm not an alcoholic, right? I still might be. I might be a functional alcoholic. My wife got upset with me because she asked me, am I an alcoholic? And I said, yes. And just didn't miss a beat. And she goes, oh my God, why do you think I'm an alcoholic? I said, you asked the question. Only an alcoholic would ask such a question, you know? And she's like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, literally, it's my job to diagnose this. You know, you're never appreciated in your own household or town. Substance dependence, on the other hand, is the physiological need for increasing amounts. You certainly can become an alcoholic where you're dependent on substances. The opiate epidemic is a good example of substance dependence. You actually become physically addicted to opiates like heroin or prescription painkillers, those sorts of things, morphine, to the point where your body actually needs it. You will go into severe withdrawals, meaning you will have pain and you could even have seizures. Some people could even die if you don't continue to get it. Tolerance is where you have biochemical changes in the body and you, what used to give you a little bit of a buzz, no longer does that. I have some Native American genes on my mama's side. My great-grandmother was full-blooded Porch Creek Indian, which makes me an eighth Porch Creek Indian. And I inherited all of the Native American low tolerance for alcohol genes. So my wife is very jealous. I can drink one beer and like, oh, it's fantastic. I feel so great. Where she has to drink about a fifth of gin to feel the same way. She's all Northern European genes, which she has a much higher tolerance for alcohol than I do. Withdrawal is physical symptoms from abstinence. You no longer are getting it, and you actually have physical symptoms that range depending on what the substance is. So examples of abuse of substances, example of some are nicotine. I wish smoking wasn't so bad for you because I really love to smoke. It's always so much fun. Whenever I go to weddings, sometimes I'll get bored in the reception and I'll look around and I often will see someone like sneak out and like, oh, I know what they're doing. They're going out to smoke. I'll follow them out. And they're always like this. They're always, oh, they're trying to hide what they're doing. And I'm like, oh man, I'm cool. I just want to bum a cigarette off of you. So we're out there smoking. And one time my mom caught me out there. She goes, oh my God, what are you doing? Mama, trying to have a cigarette here. Alcohol is one, barbiturates, tranquilizers, amphetamines, heroin, ecstasy, marijuana are all examples of substances that people will abuse. Now, the truth is that human beings have been looking for substances that alter our consciousness from the beginning of humanity. Humans need this on such a deep level. We literally invented beer before we invented the wheel. Think of that. Human beings invented beer before we invented the wheel. There is a beer recipe in ancient Egypt dating back 5,000 years, and it is delicious. The ancient Sumerians, which is a culture even older than the ancient Egyptians, had beer and wine recipes. So, you know, alcohol is one of the things that have gone back years and years and years. But if you think about how simple it is to ferment, all you need some kind of fruit juice, you need a little bit of water, and you need time. That's almost all you need, because even the natural yeast that is occurring, even in this room, will light on that, and it will ferment it, given enough time in the right conditions. So probably, you know, the first fermented beverages just got stumbled upon by accident. You know, you had an animal skin over here that had some fruit juice in it that you left a little bit too long and you forgot about it. Then, you know, Onomate going over there and he got it and he took a drink. And he goes, oh, wow, this is good stuff. So.
Do you think that the concept of self-awareness causes people to create like mind-altering substances in order to cope with like existential dread?
Is the concept of self-awareness and existential dread.
Whenever humans became like self-aware.
Yeah.
Instead of just kind of.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Consciousness is a great burden. You know, if you look at the Garden of Eden story, the biblical Garden of Eden story, from a psychological point of view, at one point in time, humanity was living in a state of bliss in paradise where all of our needs were met. And then another moment, after we became aware of the knowledge of good and evil, life became a complete and utter pain in the butt. We had to toil, we had to work for a living. It was just really difficult. Consciousness is definitely a burden on some level. And the more intelligent you are, the more aware you are of the world, sometimes the heavier the burden is. I had a child come in who later on I realized had an IQ of about 140. He was a super genius child, but he was about 10 years old. And he was like, I'm really worried that the Chinese don't really have a full grasp of the implications for thermonuclear war and what will happen if they launch missiles at us. Do you think they know? I mean, he was like, this is what this kid was worried about. You know, his peers were worried about whether or not they were going to get the next Pokemon set or whatever, you know. But, yeah, that's the burden of consciousness. And so, absolutely, often people gravitate to substances that help to alter their consciousness. So ancient cultures, there was often excessive and frequent alcohol use. The ancient Egyptians were really awesome. They had a really cool festival every year where everyone would show up and get completely and utterly smashed on alcohol. And this was a month-long event. You know, it was like Mardi Gras in ancient Egypt, but even longer. The ancients had it together a lot better than we did, I think. The Italians made their first wine. It happened in the Mediterranean. Mediterranean climate is very conducive to winemaking. And even as far as back in those days, there were problems with alcohol use that were first observed. There's even some theory that the ancient Egyptians created these festivals to kind of get it out of people's system so that the rest of the year they could work and bring the harvest in and do all the things that were necessary to keep civilization going. So alcohol abuse cuts across all ages, educational, occupational, and socioeconomic boundaries. You know, you get just as drunk on that $5 bottle of Ripple as you do on a $1,000 bottle of scotch. In fact, the molecule that actually gets you inebriated, ethyl alcohol, is exactly the same as in any kind of alcoholic beverage, whether it's wine, liquor, or beer. But often people have a psychological kind of belief that certain alcohol or certain liquors will do things to them that others won't. You know, you think about if you're drinking a glass of wine, oh, this is so sophisticated. I'm drinking a glass of wine. Oh, let me smell the bouquet. Oh, it has excellent legs. Oh, lovey, do you smell? Oh, it's so wonderful. You know, and so you have this experience where you're a sophisticated cultural person when you're drinking wine, you know. Then when you're drinking beer, you have this kind of attitude, right? I'm going to drink the beer and watch the ball game. Ethel, shut up in there. I'm trying to watch the game. Bring me some more Bill, Ethel. You know, that sort of thing. Then, you know, what happens when you drink tequila? Oh, Lord, have mercy. Anybody have bad experiences on tequila, right? Yeah.
I don't even remember it, so.
You don't even remember it. It was so difficult, yeah. So lifetime prevalence for alcohol abuse in the United States is 13%. There's enormous detrimental physical effects of it, links to accidents, of course, and violent crime. More common in men, those old men, I tell you what, if we could just get rid of them, we'd have a better society, wouldn't we? We got to get them under control. More than 37% of alcohol abusers suffer from at least one coexisting mental disorder. And there's a thought that often people, you know, turn to substances as a way to what's known as self-medicate. They're trying to medicate away some kind of symptom. I've seen often people who have a lot of anxiety turn to alcohol because alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. Anxiety is an over-aroused brain. Your central nervous system is an over-arousal, so you're trying to bring that down. And the truth is, if you're having a lot of anxiety and you drink some alcohol, you will feel better on a temporary basis. So this is psychologically reinforcing. The problem is that because of tolerance, it takes more and more and more alcohol to give you the same anti-anxiety effect. And so often that will lead to a sense of dependence. So at higher levels, alcohol depresses brain functioning. At lower levels, alcohol stimulates certain brain cells and activates the brain's pleasure areas. That's the buzz you're feeling. So hangover severity is most pronounced when alcohol blood concentration reaches a much higher level. So, you know, it goes to the old saying, you want to have a glass of water and then a drink, glass of water. You never want to drink on an empty stomach, all this sort of thing. And you want to stretch out your drinking over a long period of time It usually takes your liver about an hour to process 1 ounce of alcohol. So the more ounces you're drinking, the longer it's taking your liver to process that alcohol out, and the longer you will stay inebriated. In fact, there's even some evidence to show that if you have excessively binge drink the night before, even though when you wake up, you may feel totally sober, your blood alcohol level may still be in a dangerous zone. You still may actually test out in an illegal blood alcohol level. So excessive drinking, progression of alcohol-related disorders, there's early, mid, and late stages of that. You know, early stages, is you often have the person who is the what is known as the functional alcoholic. You know, I don't drink during the day, I only drink at night. Or I don't drink during the week, I only drink on the weekend. You have a question?
Yeah. So why do people continue drinking even after they got drunk?
The question is, why do people keep drinking even after they get drunk? I think what people are trying to, they're chasing that low-level buzz, pleasurable kind of sensation. If you are an inexperienced drinker, you often will, you know, I've seen college kids back in my day, you know, they'd take a couple of shots, they'd wait, I don't really feel anything, I'd take a couple more. Oh, okay, I'm starting to feel something. You know, the first ones are just now kicking in, right? It's all right, now I'll switch to beer. I start drinking beer. You know, now suddenly they all hit all at one time. You know, now you're totally wasted, but you've had all, you know, several of these to get you going. The larger you are, the more body mass you have, the more it takes to get drunk, you know, often. Mid-stage, people then, you know, begin to get to a point where it's affecting their work or their family or their relationship. Late stage is, you know, they're physiologically dependent on alcohol. And if you take it away from them, they can actually have something called the DTs, delirium tremens, which is actually a physiological withdrawal. They'll get tremors. You know, they'll actually need alcohol to get rid of the tremors. Physical effects, you have malnutrition, cirrhosis of liver, stomach pains. Alcohol often causes a depletion in vitamin B12, which is needed for your neurological system to maintain proper hypothalamus functioning. You can develop a disorder called Korsakoff syndrome, which is alcohol-induced dementia. And a person actually, it's actually not the alcohol that's causing this. It's a chronic depletion of B12 vitamins. It actually had become such a problem at one point in our history that the government actually thought about maybe fortifying all alcohol with B12, just like we do thiamine. You know, they put thiamine in bread to prevent birth defects. They thought about putting B12 in alcohol to prevent Korsakoff syndrome. But they never did. I guess they don't care about the alcoholics. Cirrhosis of the liver. You know, you could actually have either fatty liver or your liver begins to disintegrate. You need the liver to process toxins out of your system or you will die. Stomach pain can certainly be part of that as well. Psychosocial effects of alcohol abuse and dependence. You have chronic fatigue, oversensitivity, depression, impaired reasoning, personality deterioration. It can be quite a difficult journey watching someone drink themselves to death, and it happens. There are psychoses that are associated with severe alcohol abuse. You have what's called alcohol withdrawal delirium. That's a disorientation and hallucinations. This is the old, I see pink elephants in the living room kind of disorder. That was always the big joke back when it was still politically correct and okay socially to make fun of alcoholics. But no longer is that the case. But you can have hallucinations with it, and it can last 3 to 6 days until you finally get clear of it. Today, they actually will give you levels of alcohol in the hospital, and they will actually step you down less and less and less to kind of wean you off of it. Alcohol amnesic disorder, you have memory loss or disorientation. You can have situations where you've actually carried on behavior and done things while you were drunk, but you blacked out. You got into the blackout drunk kind of situation. Untreated, it can lead to irreversible brain damage, but of course that's very severe alcohol abuse. Causal factors in alcohol abuse, it might be biological, social, psychosocial, social, cultural. There are biological factors and genetic factors. The truth is there are certain genetic types that are less vulnerable to alcoholism and some that are more vulnerable to it. And of course, exposure and learning. So here are the areas that often will get activated with alcoholism. The prefrontal cortex, the nucleus accumbens in the ventricle, to mental area. This is the mesocortical limbic pathway. And it helps to release dopamine, which is your reward neurotransmitter. Whenever you do anything that's pleasurable, you often get a release of dopamine that enhances that pleasure, actually causes the experience of pleasure. When you have an orgasm, for example, you have a tremendous release of dopamine. When you're riding on a roller coaster, when you're in love, you have a big release of dopamine. Psychosocial causal factors in alcohol abuse and dependence is failures in parental guidance. Not watching them children. They're sneaking off and drinking. My grandmother used to say, are you drinking, son, or are you doing the marijuana? No, Grandma, I'm not doing the marijuana. I'm not drinking either. Let me smell your breath. Psychological vulnerability to it, stress, tension reduction, reinforcement. Expectations of social success. I got to drink so my friends will love me and think I'm cool. I'm going to be cool like they are. Marital or relationship crisis. Pick any country song at random, and you will hear all about how drinking happens after a marital issue. She, I'm here at the bar after my wife left me. Pour me another, bartender. There you go, I just wrote a country song. Psychocultural factors, there's cultural traditions of aggression, I'm going to drink. You may have a religious prohibition to alcoholism. My grandparents on my mother's side had an extreme religious prohibition to alcohol. If you drank alcohol, you were going to hell, and you were going to burn in hell for all eternity. Don't drink it, or you'll go to hell. Well, that really left an impression on me as a young child. And so, you know, I didn't want to drink it. Now, my grandparents on my father's side, on the other hand, drank very responsibly. You know, they had their evening toddy, had a little shot of bourbon and some ginger ale. And one summer afternoon, my grandfather was having his afternoon toddy with bourbon and ginger ale, and I came in from running around outside all day, and I was thirsty as could be, and I grabbed a drink off the counter that I thought was regular ginger ale and then drank it down real fast and then had about a 10-hour nap after that. It was a very pleasurable nap. Or geographical location, of course, depending on where you are. There are actually a couple different medicines that will actually not... They don't actually block the desire to drink. They make you violently ill if you do drink. Anabuse is one. Naltrexone is another one. Medications to lower side effects of acute withdrawal, Valium. When Valium was first discovered, they actually thought Valium was a cure for alcoholism because they would put people on Valium and they would take them off of their alcohol and they were just fine. They're all, oh, well, it's fine. Come to find out, Valium is a molecule that is almost identical to alcohol, and it fits into a receptor site in your brain in the same receptor sites that alcohol fits into. And so Valium really is nothing more than alcohol in pill form. It's kind of what it is. But they still give it now to kind of lower the withdrawal effects, and then they wean you off the Valium. But Valium itself is also addictive. Group therapy, groups like AA, NA have had an incredible amount of success over the years in helping people to overcome their alcoholism, all those 12-step programs that were actually invented and arose out of Jungian theory. The theory behind it is that Jung said that the reason people do substances and they get hooked on substances or they have substance abuses, particularly alcohol, is they are trying to fill a religious or spiritual void in their life. And if you help them to find a sense of religion or spirituality, then they will no longer have to turn to the substance any longer. And it seems to have some positive effects, AA and NA does. Environmental intervention, putting people in halfway houses so they are more monitored, they have more structured living. Behavioral and cognitive therapy, like adverse conditioning, skills training, or self-control, all helps. So other approaches are controlled drinking rather than abstinence, actually teaching someone how to drink responsibly. And believe it or not, there's plenty of people who learn how to do that. Even after years of being binge drinkers, they learn how to drink responsibly. So a lot of different programs have different levels of success. And honestly, it just really depends a lot of times on the motivation of the individual and whether or not they've hit bottom or not. Some people aren't quite ready to give it up. All right, so other drugs of dependence are narcotics, sedatives, stimulants, anti-anxiety drugs like Xanax, pain medications, hallucinogens, all can have either abuse or dependence issues. Opium is probably one of the biggest problem of abuse, morphine, heroin, codeine. I'm actually allergic to opiates, particularly codeine. I break out in a rash, I have a severe asthma attack, and can't catch my breath, and will have a very negative reaction for it. So unfortunately, whenever the few times I've had surgery, I've been unable to be prescribed any kind of opium-based painkiller, so they usually just give me some strong version of Tylenol or something along those lines. The immediate effects of narcotics is the alleviation of physical pain, relaxation, and a very pleasant reverie, a sense of euphoria, alleviation of anxiety and tension. You can see why, wow, you know, people really get psychologically addicted to this as well as physically, because it does have a lot of pleasurable effects. Long-term effects, physiological craving for the drug, withdrawal symptoms, and then a gradual deterioration of well-being. I can almost spot a heroin addict across the room. You know, they're obvious. They're usually gaunt. You know, they've stopped eating. You just can almost spot them. There's a lot of work recently with hallucinogens that have been shown to be positive. The ancient Greeks had a saying that the only difference between a poison and a medicine is the amount, the dosage level that you are giving someone. And there probably is a lot of truth to that. One of the things that hallucinogens have been shown to do is dramatically reduce depression and anxiety. They're working on a whole new class of antidepressant medications that don't take 6 to 8 weeks to work, that take 1 to 2 hours to work or less. There was a great study that you should look up, and I'll try to post it on the web courses for you too. It's really interesting. But it was done by John Hopkins University in their medical center, where they actually took the active ingredient of magic mushrooms. The active ingredient is psilocybin. And they gave it to people who were suffering from chronic, irretractable depression. This was a 20 to 25 person study that they did. And if you've ever used hallucinogens or used magic mushrooms, that is a very long, long high. It's not like a temporary jolt and then you're done. I mean, if you do that, settle in for a good 6 to 8 hours worth of a experience, depending on the level of psilocybin. Another thing that our culture doesn't do very well, that tribal cultures, hunter-gatherer cultures do very well, is prepare a person psychologically to take mind-altering substances. In many tribes, in Native American tribes, in tribes in South America, in African tribes, before you do any kind of mind-altering substance that's going to send you on some kind of vision quest, you have to go through a very long series of rites and rituals that prepare you psychologically for what you're going to experience. Guess how many of them develop substance abuse disorders with these hallucinogens? None of them do. It's almost not prevalent at all. Hallucinogens generally are not physiologically addictive. People can get psychologically addicted to them on occasion. It just depends on the situation. Psilocybin has been shown to be the safest recreational drug or hallucinogen that exists. Now, saying that, please don't go out and use magic mushrooms and then say,
Dr. Saunders told me in class it's the safest one, so I'm going to use it.
Right. You know, again, you got to be psychologically prepared to use these sorts of things. Psilocybin, though, is one that's been shown to be very effective in reducing depression. In the John Hopkins study, after they administered the psilocybin, this is one dose and one experience, 2 years later, people had put their depression into complete remission. They still reported an enhanced sense of well-being, an optimistic, hopeful view of the world. They all reported having a profound, what the participants would characterize as a profound spiritual experience while using the psilocybin. Really fascinating. Ayahuasca is another one that's often used. You see that down in South America a lot. It's made its way up here to the United States. There are charlatans around who will be claiming to be, you know, I'm trained in the shamanic tradition of the South American tribes, and I will take you through this incredible experience with the ayahuasca. Be careful who you believe with that sort of thing. You never know who you're going to get involved with. There's been a lot of reports of people doing that. They get drugged, they get, raped or robbed, that sort of stuff. So obviously, look for reliable sources if you're even thinking about that sort of thing. Ecstasy, there's new studies on ecstasy. There's been a long-term study on using ecstasy or MDMA, low levels of that, in psychotherapy. Believe it or not, back in the 60s, MDMA was actually originally created as a psychotherapy enhancement. They recently used it, and you can look up this study, as a study using it as a way to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's been shown to be incredibly effective, and about 80 to 90% of the people had total remission of their post-traumatic stress when they had psychotherapy coupled with the low levels of the MDMA. They're looking at both psilocybin and MDMA have been fast-tracked by the FDA into creating some kind of medicines based on these drugs that will help with both post-traumatic stress and depression. So that's looking very optimistic. Currently, The drug known as ketamine, which is a, veterinarians use it as a horse tranquilizer, is also used in humans as an anesthetic. It's known on the street as Special K, of all things, if you ever heard of a Special K. But it's also a hallucinogen. It's very similar to psilocybin in its effect. It gives you an out-of-body kind of experience. It's been shown to give incredibly fast remission of depression. There are psychiatrists, because it's already a legal drug, there are psychiatrists here in the state of Florida. One is in Maitland. There's also one down in Tampa that will give you ketamine therapy for your depression. You have to meet a certain number of protocols for it. You have to have used SSRIs like Prozac or Zoloft for a certain number of months, and it's shown to be ineffective before they'll do the ketamine therapy with you. But that's been shown to be incredibly effective as well. Politically, I'm very libertarian in my beliefs, and I think that the war on drugs is a terrible thing, and it should be ended, and we all should be able to, all these drugs should be legal, but regulated, just like we do alcohol. And, you know, people should be given the opportunity to use them, particularly the ones that seem to have medicinal properties. I think the marijuana and the push to legalize marijuana has been very beneficial. A lot of people, you know, I knew guys when I worked at the federal prison who were doing like 15 years for growing marijuana. In fact, I had one guy in there who had the largest marijuana crop. He had a 100-acre marijuana crop. In fact, it was so huge and so obvious that the cops didn't even think that it could possibly be marijuana. Like, they'd drive by it every day and be like, and he was out there, like, on his tractor, harvesting up his marijuana crop, baling it up like hay, shipping it all over the country. You know, and it was so blatant that he got away with this for years. You know, it was crazy. Yeah.
So, like, with all the push to legalize marijuana and everything, do you think that, like, I don't know, I feel like there's a lot of political point of views where they're just, like, so I feel like a lot of Republican people are just very, like, against it, so it'll be, like, very hard to push these things into, like, being able to be used for helpful things like therapies and stuff like that. So I just feel like, because there's such a long period of time where it's been studied, like there's been a lot of studies with like LSD and psilocybin and all these things, but like nobody ever has done more with it because there's so many people that are just really against it. Like I feel like it's never going to be able to be achieved.
I feel more confident that that's not going to happen. I think the tide is really turning. You know, I mean, Florida is a super Republican state, and I mean, the people polled, 75% are pro marijuana legalization. That's a huge number of Republicans that said yes to that. You know, and I think part of it is because people see what the war on drugs has done to families, and you know, it's been really devastating to a lot of people, where you know, you have fathers who get ripped away from their families for, you know, what it really amounts to, these really low-level kind of drug crimes that aren't hurting anyone. And the one thing that boggles my mind is that we learned nothing from alcohol prohibition. We already did this experiment back in the 1920s. And all through the 1920s into the early 30s, alcohol was illegal throughout the United States. And what did it do? It created massive amounts of crime, because the only people who were selling alcohol were criminals by definition. You know, that's when Al Capone arose, and you had all those kingpins. One of the things that's happening, and one of the reasons there's so much drug violence at the moment over the last 2 or 3 years along the Mexican border, is because the drug kingpins are chasing fewer and fewer and fewer customers. Because marijuana has been legalized in so many different states, you can get it legally now. You don't have to get it on the streets anymore. And so a lot of people are turning to the legal versions of it. So I'm cautiously optimistic. The the low-level paranoid personality part of me says that, you know, one of the reasons why the government wants to keep drugs illegal is it gives them an incredible amount of power. You know, there's so much power. If they even suspect you, like, believe it or not, this is actually legal. A cop can pull you over, say they smelled alcohol, or say they smelled marijuana in your car, or they find paraphernalia, quote unquote. They find a syringe or something, and they can actually confiscate your car, confiscate all your property, without charging you with anything, any kind of crime, and they quote unquote arrest the property, and the burden of proof then is switched. You have to take the government to court and prove that car was not purchased with drug profits, and you know you have to prove you're not doing drugs or you're not selling drugs. How do you prove that? You know, and so the confiscation and that kind of stuff and the power it gives them is just ridiculous. That's another one of the big reasons why, you know, I've been against it. But and that's the biggest resistance of it, because, you know, the politicians see how much power this gives people and they don't want to let it go. But I think the people generally are sick of it. And so that's why you're having all this voting against it, and they're trying to legalize this. I have no desire to go do marijuana all the time. But I think it should be alcohol, should be legal, like alcohol is, you know, and let people decide for themselves. All right, well, I've recorded all this, and now the cops are probably going to show up and cart me away, so I'll have to edit this.